It really is an honor. I don't mean that lightly, to read here in the mission, because this place holds so many of my past dreams. I was born and raised in the San Joaquin Valley, and when I was, in my early 20s, I started hanging around Fresno because I heard there was poets there. and then when I got to Fresno, there were only two poets there. Juan Felipe Herrera and his wife Margarita Luna Robles. And those two beautiful souls pointed me to San Francisco. They said, you should, if you want to, you know, do some more readings, you should probably go to San Francisco, check out Alejandro Murguia, who's there. And they said, in fact, we'll put you in touch with a good friend of ours who's from Fresno. His name is Victor Martinez. And I said, okay, sounds good. So I came to San Francisco looking for Victor Martinez, and I knocked on his little door on Cap Street at the time, and he had just written Parrot in the Oven, which won the National Book Award. And so we became friends, and I would come often just to visit Victor here in the mission, and we would walk around, and I would dream up dreams, and he would say, you know, he would pat me on the back and say, you know, in his beautiful feathery voice, you know, you can do it, man, you can do it, you know. And one time when I finally had a reading here in San Francisco, one of the first readings I had was at the Intersection for the Arts, and I was so nervous. I was at Victor's house right here, and I was really nervous that day. And I mean, I had all my poems in my back pocket, and I was like trembling as we were walking up the street. And he looks at me, and he goes, "Are you nervous, Tim?" And I said, "Yeah, I kind of am. I'm a little bit nervous, you know." And he put his hand on my back, and he said, "Listen, you don't have anything to be nervous about." As we were walking to the Intersection for the Arts, and he said, "Because whoever is there, they're there because they're ready to hear your work. So you've already won them over. So you got nothing to worry about. They're on your side." And so I want to say that in honor of Victor Martinez, you know, presente. And let's all say that for Victor Martinez, presente. Wonderful. And then as a kid growing up in the San Joaquin Valley, you cannot drive anywhere without seeing the Sun Made Raisins sign. You're at the Sun Made Raisins that we all see those commercials and on PBS and things like that. But you always pass by the giant billboards with the Sun Made, lady in the bonnet and all that. And when I finally was out of that area and began studying art and all of that, one of the first wonderful images that ever struck me was the image by the wonderful artist Esther Hernandez, who is here. Esther, I gotta, you know, give you a shout out for that also. Esther Hernandez was here, and her image, her iconic image, was of the Sun Made, the lady wearing the bonnet, but it was a calavera, a skeleton face, saying naturally sprayed with herbicides, pesticides, DDT, all these things. And I remember thinking, wow, who is this person, and where does she exist? And I found out that she was right here in the mission also, so it's like coming home as well. And the other person I want to mention is also a teacher of mine, who invited me out here in 1999 to work with her, paint a mural at the San Francisco airport. At the time, they were just adding the new extension there, and she took a risk on me, a writer from Fresno, and she took a risk on me to be an apprentice. And there's nothing I can say that you probably don't know about Juana Alicia and her work. Did the Women's Building, a Maestra piece, and who did all the wonderful murals that are here in the Mission District. And in fact, I was at San Francisco State today, and I saw her mural there as well, with Juan Felipe's poem, Mission Street Manifesto, Rise, Brothers, Rise, Sisters. It was a beautiful, beautiful. And so Juan Alicia is here. Juan Alicia. So I'm going to read a little bit from All They Will Call You. I'm going to share some of that. And I'm going to actually, but before I do that, just to kind of get it kicked off on a lighter note and to warm myself up, I'm going to read a poem that I wrote a couple of years after working with Juan Alicia here, because we would meet up at her house in Berkeley, and we would drive to the San Francisco airport every morning, like at 5 a.m, and we would work there, and she's a hard worker, and we would work for like 15 hours a day, and that's no joke. And then, because we would be so immersed in the work and the painting, we would stop in, I don't even remember, in somewhere here in South San Francisco, we'd stop at this meat market, and I'll just read you the poem. But the poem comes based on that experience, actually. It was a poem I wrote a few years. It's actually called My Name is Hernandez, and it's after a poem by Martin Espada, who wrote My Name is Espada. It means descendant of Hernán Cortés, so I heard. said Spaniard, who slayed Moctezuma and a nation of ore, occupied the territories known as the Southwest. Enslaved captives who stood in venomous marshes of mud and thicket, forced to shoulder slabs of glass, shard, obsidian, pummel the soft gold, wading in unknown depths, drowned for the nugget from tule, from root, mules the rotund, mounds of clay up mountain crags, named for gods with uncollected depths to shape indestructible pylons of new empires rising. But I'm not that serious by any means. I watch TV in my boxers, and I eat sardines from the can, and I breathe on my children's faces just to watch them shriek. My name is Hernandez. My father is a field worker. Every sugar beet that you have ever eaten, he's shorn away what threatened to destroy it. When I was born, he wore me on his back while slouching over a short-handled hoe in the monsoon plains of five Wyoming summers. There is too much here for memory to be accurate. My father's worked since the day of his conception, a shoeshine boy in the parlors of South Texas. The adobe tiles were relics from days of indentured servitude, earthen ray, red clay shingles the boy destroyed with his rifle. But mezquite is what my father recalls the most, how the chicharra song is a quantum thread between this life and that old life. I see him now, my father, behind the wheel of a semi, hazardous materials, head a snow-capped slab of worry, illuminated only by the coo of his grandson's voice, the most fragile ammonite coiled in the shape of his own hand. My name is Hernandez, born of a woman who was born of a woman who was born of a woman. And I have said this before. Don't let her flexible disposition fool you. Consider the blade of a palm leaf on Palm Sunday. She is devoted to the countdown of years starting from 10. Her time here is limited. She knows this. Same is true for the rest of us. Except my mother has gotten good at forgetting this. We haven't. We miss. She lets on a permanence not seen since the resurrection. My name is Hernandez, of a Dinuba sanitarium that crumbled in 1989, of an elementary school hidden between a plum orchard and the voluptuous golden thigh of a foothill, of an education that included the neon powder of sulfur, of menial jobs and fast food dives, of 30 days in jail and then five more, of flea markets and strip malls, of TV round the clock, of relationships to things and people that rarely go the distance, of constantly risking solitude, of my grandfather on Magnolia Way, who pickles eggs in a tin shed behind a sulking house, of the twin abortions, of regrets, of saying things like regret because it's expected, of reneging on words, of doctoring the wounds with words, of admitting he knows nothing of words. So years ago, while working in South San Francisco, I walked into a carniceria, a meat market, with my last name, Hernandez, emblazoned on the window. And behind there was a young man draped in a blood apron, and he greeted me, and I ordered tres tacos de lengua, I told him. Smiling, I also told him, I'm a Hernandez too. Yes, he replied, handing me my change, dicing the cow's last word on the cutting block. There are millions of us here, he said, millions of Hernandezes, each one expecting some kind of deal. Thank you. And because I'm from Fresno, but I no longer live there, it's always like, what do they say about Indiana? The best view of Indiana is from the rear view. And so, from the rear view. So I've often felt like that about Fresno. It's a city that I have such a love-hate relationship with. I love to be from Fresno. I just don't like to be in Fresno. That's the truth, that is. Adios, Fresno. You could use more letters of love. Here, take these. You owe me nothing, except back pay. But I won't mention it again. Trust me when I say I'll have no regrets leaving you. Sure, I'll hear it from the homebodies, the deadpan hearts who were born loath and begged to die amidst your drug poppies. You can keep your fields. The sun will follow me. I won't reconsider. I've overstayed my welcome by three generations. The musicians will be all right, by which I mean Lance Canales will be all right, by which I mean he'll get the work done. A G-string hangs over the baseball stadium on opening night where the whores go two for a buck beneath the peeling paint of Home Run Alley. Fresno. Your mosques are waning, and your restaurant kitchens are wetter than before. Even the hungry are gutting cows in the pastures now. The farmers buy their vegetables in supermarkets, you know. There is a difference between Lost and Laos. One day you'll have all the water you need. Your statue of David of Sassoon could use a rest, Fresno. Don't bother looking for me. I will be lost to myself for the next 100 cycles on a mountain near Red Feather Lakes. Caught up in raising three children who won't mistake the humming of bees for their own ambition. Fresno, I can see your underwear through the hole in your jeans. If I wanted to be politically correct, I would have registered my vehicle. I won't miss the pretense or the way your midnight reeks. I might miss the smell of a huele de noche during baseball season or the cut grass at Grizzly Stadium. See that right there? Shit, you're playing to my nostalgia again. That's all you're good for. I'm glad you and I never had children. There would have been this thing of blood between us. Don't get sappy on me now. Outside, the truckers are grinding their axles and the exhaust pipes got the bulldogs going next door. You look pitiful when you're in love. I didn't say beautiful. This drought suits you. Am I being too hard? You'll get over it. The refrigerator almost burnt the house down last night, and I kept thinking, Fresno, somehow you were responsible for it. The bullet hole in my fence can only stare so long. My cousin Art is in rehab now, but the silos won't shut up. Your landscape talks the loudest shit in summer. Fresno, you try too hard. Why'd you have to take Victor Martinez from us? Why'd you have to take Mia Barraza from us? Why'd you take Andres Montoya from us? Fresno, I might return only if you promise to be good. It's just that I can't stand the heat, see? There are too many I can't stand, as many fruit stands. My mind is a packing house with a sagging conveyor belt. Strawberries should taste so tart. Oranges, they should fit in the palm of an adult hand. There's no such thing as windfall. A pluot is incest at its finest. Enough said. Fresno, adios. Thank you. I'm just going to read a couple of excerpts from the from All They Will Call You, which is about the plane crash in 1948. We did a wonderful discussion today at San Francisco State there at the Poetry Center with Steve and, of course, with my comrades over here, Margarit Munoz and Rene Vasquez. Did a really nice in-depth discussion. And so we talked a lot about the technical aspects of the book. And so what I'm going to do is actually enjoy the poetic aspects of the book. I'm going to actually just read some of the poems for you, okay? And you know, you all know it's based on a song, 1948, plane crash, and the last 10 years I spent my life searching for every passenger on that airplane. So that said, I'm going to read first from a just a small excerpt from, actually, I'm just going to go there. Should I go there? I'm going to go there. All right. Somebody's all about going there. That's cool. I had actually went all across the country at some point in the mid, like 2005, 2006. And then later on, I want to say when I really got into this book and I started to, I've always kind of been an airplane fanatic. I'll just say that first. And they have this really great boneyard, airplane boneyard in Tucson, Arizona. But once I really got immersed into the book, I started to want to find an exact replica of this airplane that killed these 32 passengers. And it was a Douglas DC-3 airplane, basically. It was the workhorse of World War II. And it left Oakland, and it was flying to El Centro on the border. And I wanted to find an exact replica. So everywhere I'd go and get invited to do a reading, I would always look up, like if I was invited me to like Tucson or they invited me to Chicago, I would try and look up online to see if there was an airplane spot somewhere around that area where I could go look at. There was never any. There was one in Turlock, but it was there. It was a full airplane. It looked really old and ratty. And I told the guy, can I go inside it? And he said, it was like a museum there in Turlock, and he said, we have to charge you $100 to go to look inside. I was like, $100? Who was the last person that went inside that airplane? You know? I see a bunch of birds in there. They're in there for free. Let me in there, man. And he said, no, we got to charge you $100. That's the tour. And I was like, forget it then. So I kind of looked around. It took pictures. Anyway, when I ended up moving to El Paso in 2014, I found a War Eagles Museum 5 minutes from my house, and it had a fully restored Douglas DC-3 airplane. So inside and out, it's a gorgeous museum if you're ever in El Paso. And so I went there and I talked to the guys and I told him what my book was about and the research. And he said, I will take you to the, because he started telling me about all the airplanes. Let me tell you about the helicopters we got and the old motorcycles and the whatever. And I was just, I'm just here for the airplane, man, the Douglas DC-3, that's all I want to see. And he says, oh yeah, you'll like it, come on. So he shows it to me, and it's behind this beautiful velvet ropes. You know, it's a museum. And I'm looking at the airplane, and it's gorgeous. It's shiny, it's fully restored. And then I said, can I go inside it? And he goes, yeah, you can go inside it. Come on, I'll take you in. Psh, opens the door. Psh. We walk inside. It's fully restored inside. And it was just an amazing, so I tell him, you know, is there any way that I can sit inside the airplane for a little bit and just write. And he goes, you know what? You tell me when you want to do it, and we will rope off the exhibit and shut it down so that you can write inside of here. So I wrote the entire plane crash scene from inside of sitting inside of a Douglas DC-3 airplane in El Paso, Texas. Hey, that's worth it. Thank you. So big props to the War Eagles Museum. Having said that, I had to use a lot of poetry for the difficult scene of the plane crash. So that's what I'm going to share with you, actually. When Luis Miranda Cuevas watched his left leg tear away from the body, more than likely he was unable to comprehend it was his left leg. His mouth agape, gasping for air, while his eyes snapped photos methodically, tumbling in a free fall. Even the sky wasn't real. Maybe it appeared like a still puddle of water on the warm surface of Lake Chapala, where as a child he spent his days fishing beneath the sun. There's a small part of the brain, you see, where memory is stored. It's called the hippocampus. In moments of intense trauma, the specific node of brain goes into shock. Any number of memories haphazardly flashes as quick as a camera bulb. The string of blood that poured from Luis's own torn leg could have very well been the bugambilia crawling across his girlfriend Casimira's bedroom window in Jocotepec. Mi cara de dolorosa, he used to call her. The sensation of falling at terminal velocity, where a flailing body can reach up to speeds of 124 miles per hour, may as well have been the sensation of birth. No longer were their souls inside of their skin. They were between worlds now, dead and alive at the same time. Screams for Diosito, if ever they had come, had done so from disembodied mouths. The ship rolled once, twice. It shook loose another body. Out spilled the youngest of them, Tomas Marquez, strapped to his seat. He was strapped to his seat, intact, but aflame, somersaulting across the morning sky. Because of the weight of the seat, it's likely that he reached a terminal velocity of 150 miles per hour, a fireball of lightning. In the explosion, in the spray of molten metal, passengers disintegrated, turned to ash. Perhaps one of the brothers was first, Juan Ruiz, ash, and then perhaps Officer Chafin, ash. Perhaps the gun on Chafin's hip fired its only round. An explosion was heard, according to the reports, but no evidence of an explosion was ever found. Row after row, those who were strapped to their seats, witnessing their own end, could only make a final gesture, an attempt to cross oneself, perhaps a blink of an eye. At the same moment, Red Childers witnessed this, standing on the floor of Los Gatos Canyon, looking up at the spiraling ship. 100 inmates from the nearby prison camp had gathered in the main yard. Rudy Larson, the cook, he spotted the smoke first. He hollered and he pointed up at the left wing as it exploded and ripped free. The sonic boom echoed down the length of the canyon, forcing the men onto the ground. A ball of fire meteored east of the Gaston House. Of all the passengers, Frank Atkinson was the only one, the pilot, was the only one who saw it coming. Unconscious, Ewing, his co-pilot, Ewing's body was limp now and pinned against the gears. When Frankie could no longer distinguish the spinning of the horizon line from the plane's propeller, he knew there was nothing left to do. In that moment, Captain Frank Atkinson, a one-manned army of greased lightning, a decorated World War II hero could do, with more than 2,000 hours flying in this over the most hostile territories known to man, all he could do was take a deep breath and let go control of the yoke. He watched the sky spinning, perhaps felt his skin catch fire, and the mountainside appeared closer. Closer still. Maybe he shut his eyes. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he thought of his unborn child inside his wife Bobby's womb. Again, the hippocampus triggered. It's a crapshoot. Whatever blip of memory surfaces is the final impression of our lives. For Frankie, it could have been the memory of the last photograph he took with his parents. It was a pleasant day, the smell of rose bushes. Perhaps it was the image of his namesake, St. Francis, who courted poverty and conversed with creatures and birds, who preached, "Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Wherever there is hatred, let me sow love." When the wing broke off, it sailed over the Gaston House, where young Nancy was playing near the creek bed. She was 7. The snapping of the tree branches caused her to look up. In an instant, she saw what she considered to be a metallic feather bouncing on the breeze. It was the wing of the airplane. And as it approached her, it grew in size. She tried moving away from it, but the thing seemed to follow her. She couldn't escape it. She zigzagged back and forth several times, but the monster, she would call it the monster, was hell-bent on making her its target. And it sailed toward Nancy, and she ran screaming onto the porch of the house, and when she looked back, it was gone. A second later, it crashed down 30 feet away. When the wing came down, so did a rain, unlike any little Nancy had ever seen. It rained paper, ladies' garments, unexplainable number of shoes, baby clothes, a 50-cent piece burnt black, torn wool coat, a finger with wedding band on it, driver's license in pants pocket, address L Street in Sacramento, red flannel work shirt, baseball cap with the letter S, battered suitcase, handwritten letter addressed to Folsom, California, photograph an unknown woman, Mexican blanket or serape or something, laundry workers union card from San Francisco, a red high heel with foot inside. Thank you. One of my favorite stories is about a young man named Luis Miranda Cuevas, who was in Jocotepec, Jalisco. And I have to say, again, wonderful work to Rene and Margarit for reading poems that were sort of thematic along some of the book's subjects. So thank you for that. But Luis had actually come out to Watsonville. His family's still there in Watsonville to this day, actually. But Luis came out to Watsonville to pick strawberries when he was caught and sent home. Before he did, he made a last phone call to his fiance, a beautiful young lady by the name of Casimira. And he told her, Casimira, they're bringing all of us back. We're going to be back on an airplane. And when I arrive to Jocotepec, I'm going to be bringing you a mariachi and we're going to get married. And that's what she remembered, the last conversation she had. And then the next thing she knew, she was standing on the corner market listening to the radio, because that's what they did in the 40s there, and they heard the news come on. And the news, it was the radio that said there was a terrible plane crash of braceros, who were part of the bracero program, and they read the names of all the passengers over the radio waves throughout Mexico, and that's where she heard that her young lover, Luis Miranda Cuevas, was killed in this plane crash. Luis came through the bracero program, and I'm going to read this section of the evaluation test of the bracero program. You had to take a test whenever you wanted to be part of the program to come prove you were worthy of coming to the United States to work. The evaluation was a test of degradation. If a worker could endure the test, then they could certainly endure life as a bracero in the North. First, Luis's upper eyelids were turned inside out and inspected for conjunctivitis. And then his mouth prodded and examined for sores or abscesses, any signs of declining health. If his body had any scars on it, even just one, he would be turned away and scorned. We don't want troublemakers here. Next, Luis's testicles were gripped and kneaded by strange fingers, after which he was made to bend over, spread his cheeks so that his anus could be scrutinized and prodded with a tongue depressor. His hands were then examined for calluses, a sure sign of whether or not a man was capable of hard work. Often, see, men would cut their hands or work a shovel handle days before the examination just to build up a good callus. No callus meant no job. Once Luis's physical state was determined, then he was asked to assemble a children's puzzle of Dumbo the elephant to assess his intellect. Men could not be, quote, too dumb nor, quote, too smart. It was a, quote, specific kind of worker they were looking for, one that was, quote, fit enough to perform the necessary duties of a field laborer, while at the same time would not look to raise trouble. That's from the actual recruitment records. For this reason, Luis Miranda Cuevas would keep his eyes lowered to the ground so as not to appear threatening. It was one of the many lessons he was taught by some of the more experienced enganchados. Luis would pass his test, and eventually he would be admitted to work in the United States. To officiate the passing, the Bracero Program Welcoming Committee would initiate him with a ritual delousing of DDT. A powerful insecticide they would spray from the top of his black hair into his ears, across his eyelids, into his nostrils, down over his cold, trembling, naked body, into the creases and folds of his partes nobles, hair follicles, between his fingers, between his toes, the soles of his feet, and back up again. Before handing Luis back his clothes, they would first be dipped in a bath of Zyklon B, the same chemical agent used to extinguish human lives in the gas chambers of Nazi Germany. Once a large batch of workers was approved, the enganchados would celebrate by smoking hand-rolled cigarettes while waiting yet again for the names to be called. Hours later, they would find themselves standing at the foot of the wide white gates to Los Estados Unidos being waved across, perhaps in El Paso, perhaps in Laredo, papers in hand. Among them, there, exhausted, hungry, but excited all at once, stood Luis Miranda Cuevas. Next stop, Watsonville. Thank you. I want to just say it here because I'm basically done, but I want to say that thank you so much to Steve and the Poetry Center for having me, for bringing me out here, for making it possible. Thank you also to Renee and to Marguerite, and thank you to my friends who have also made it, Maria Martinez, wonderful. Thank you to have you all here as well. Like I said, it's really an honor to be here in the Mission reading poetry and sharing stories, and we have copies of All They Will Call You here for sale as well, the paperback, so it's affordable. And I'll be happy to sign it. Thank you all. Bravo.